said, we started a brand new series last week called Influence This Cultural Moment. And last week, Pastor Matt talked about the concept of modern spiritualism, to where it's more about Jesus redeeming a life that's surrendered rather than just creating a spiritual experience. And I think culture has influenced the church in a lot of different ways. And in a lot of this influence we're talking about is not necessarily a specific thing you can point at. It's more of like a slow drift over time. And I think we can see that in a lot of different areas. But in America specifically, I believe we've been convinced of this lie that it's more about a moment or an experience that we have than a lifestyle or a way that we choose to follow Jesus with the way that we're living. And in the series, we're defining influence like this. We're saying that influence is the capacity to indirectly affect the behavior, the development, or the opinions of others. It's a compelling force that produces effects without relying on direct force, authority, or command. In a nutshell, I think it's that drift over time. It's that force that kind of pushes you off course and influences you towards a direction they want you to go in. And the Bible speaks directly about this idea of influence. In Romans 12, verse 2, we see how we're supposed to go completely against this. It says, don't copy the behavior and customs of this world. Don't allow culture to influence you around that. Instead, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way that you think. Then you will learn to know God's perfect will for you, which is good and pleasing and perfect. Matt put it this way, that our culture has kept that longing for God while discarding the God who created the longing in the first place. Because there's a longing deep in each person for God. And when God is replaced, we're going to see later today as we talk about this on a personal level, when we see God removed from that, there's implications on implications on implications in how we not just live our lives, but how we experience life with one another. It's essentially like it's the cone without the ice cream. It's the story without the plot. As we allow culture to dictate more and more to us, I believe that we find ourselves still wanting more because it's not lasting. It's not fulfilling. It's fleeting. It's something that leaves us and is not something that actually sustains us over time. And last week, we talked more on like a broad scale, like as the church as a whole, how it hits. And this morning, I want to shift the conversation to be more personal. How is culture directly influencing us individually? And what is culture actually influencing us towards valuing? And if I had to sum it up in a word for us individually, as each person, I would say that it's personal freedom. Personal freedom. And that might feel off the rip, like that's not a big deal. I mean, especially like we live in America where like freedom is a core value of our country. And I think that is a good thing that's been fought and paid for and bought by the suffering and the struggles of many people to put us in a place where we are fortunate to enjoy the benefits of having personal freedom. However, I think even though it's a treasure for us as Americans, when we apply it to our spiritual lives is where we get into a lot of trouble. Because I think the freedom that we feel like we have, where I can do what I want, I can be who I want, I can do all these things, that freedom that we can enjoy can actually lead us to a place where we're actually lonely, where it isolates us, because we place ourselves above anything else in our lives. We have the freedom to be ourselves, to do what we want, but putting yourselves above others, above greater ideals, above what Jesus calls us to do and how he calls us to live will only lead us to one place, and that's isolation and individualization. Our culture tells us to trust yourself, to follow your heart, do what's best for you. Nobody can tell you who you are. And a few of these are kind of sneaky because they're not like innately bad. Like what's wrong with trusting your gut and following your passions, you know? Especially like we had a bunch of kids just graduate. Isn't that what we're preaching to them? Like follow your heart. Go after those things. Like we want to inspire the next generation to do great things, but it's about where they're placing their trust and their confidence and their values. Is it on themselves? Is it on putting themselves above others? Or is it about using those for the benefits of others? I would say this. I would say almost without exception that following a call, that call from culture to place your desires, your truth, your perspective above everything else points to one core issue that each one of us has to varying degrees. And that issue is we all have a need for control. We have a need for control. We like to construct and control the things around us. And consider that for a moment. This culture is urging you to place yourself and your needs and your wants above others, to indulge your selfish thoughts, indulge your selfish ambitions, because you deserve it. And that reveals, like, that at the core of it, like the root core of why it's pushing us towards those things is because it knows we like to have control. But Jesus, when we look at the Bible, we look at how he teaches us. He teaches a life where we lay ourselves down for the sake of others, where we bear, where we take up our own crosses, not our own desires and preferences. We choose to bear burdens with one another. To put it this way, this is where we're going to camp this morning, that our culture preaches self-reliance. Trust in yourself. Put your faith in yourself, what you want, where you want to be. Your perspective is the right perspective. But Jesus, instead, invites us as he teaches the value of a shared life. And a shared life is more than just a conversation on Sunday between services. It's more than just a few texts we can send out to our friends during the week. Those are all good things. But the life that Jesus calls us to is one of sacrifice. It's one of humility. It's one of ultimately choosing to walk this road of life with other people. And Jesus challenges us. He challenges the opposite of what culture does, which is not about relying on what you can do, but it's about sharing your life and seeing what you can do for others. Jesus says this in Matthew 16, and I think this paints the most clear picture of the life he's calling us to live. In verse 24, he says this, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way.'" It's not about your preference. It's not about your ideals. It's not about your even perspective, your truth. You have to lay all that down. He says, take up your cross and follow me. And he finishes out by saying this, if you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. And Jesus is saying this to a community, saying it to his disciples. And everywhere we look in the Bible, even from the very beginning, we don't see individualism. We don't see the encouragement to, like, kind of hoard yourself off to yourself. We see that opening to community, how we're designed to be in community. We see connection. Isolation is not an ideal or a value in the Bible. It's often a consequence of sin. When you consider the gospel, that's the core consequence of we had perfect union with God. We sinned against God, which caused separation, which caused isolation. It's not the cherry on top because now we get to do things our way. It's we are separated from God because we chose to go against him, to go our own way. And we are fortunate to be reconciled with him because of Jesus and the work he did on the cross and the grace he extends to each one of us. But this idea of individualism being the end-all, be-all, being the thing that we're trying to get to, trust yourself. Your truth is what matters. Your perspective is what matters, puts us in a terrible situation, because I'd go as far to say this, that individualism is more than just a preference, a thing that I like. It's a theology. And theology just means the way that we think about God. Individualism, a theology of individualism, it replaces God with yourself. It makes that swap for, like, we have our focus and our heart set on God and what is holy and what is good to him. And instead, we swap ourselves there. You might not put it that way. You might not say it in those exact terms. But when you begin to build a life around the freedom that you have to be who you want and think how you want and say the things you want and to treat people the way that you want, you're building a life where you're, one, isolating yourself from others. You're building these walls up because of the walls that you're building, built on how you see things. And two, you're removing God from his designed place. You're lifting yourself up to a place where you're not meant to be. And that's where culture tries to downplay the reality of this perspective. It's not that bad. Like, you deserve this. Culture treats this as a preference, like a few settings that you might change on the operating system of your life. Like, I like this more than this. I want to increase this more than this other thing in my life. Maybe in a phrase, treat yourself. Like, do your thing. It's not that big a deal. And that's where that slow drift over time puts us in a place we do not want to be. We replace ourselves where God should be. And again, the biggest danger of this theology is that the individual moves God from that rightful place. We end up in a place where it's, I decide what's true. I decide what's right from my perspective. I decide who I am and what I need. You start building those walls up. This is what I think. And what you think can't control what I say or what I think or how I believe. And as a result of that reality, it puts us in a place where there's no need for correction. There's no one there to tell me what I can do, so I can do whatever I want. There's no need for accountability. I don't have to be accountable for what I say because I'm the only one who's judging myself. You see this? There's no need for commitment. Because I'm isolated to myself, the only thing I'm committed to is myself and my ideals and my perspective. I am now God in this situation because I'm the one who defines these ideals. You see this? That's the reality. Individual freedom, sure. But you create a very lonely and empty existence. There's a pastor out in California, Irwin McManus, that I heard say something around this past week, and I thought it really just put the nail, or hit the nail on the head. And he said, whenever you make your personal happiness, like your ideal, your individual perspective, your highest priority, you will always relinquish your personal responsibility. I'm not accountable to others because all that matters is what I want and my happiness. I don't need to be in this relationship anymore. It doesn't make me happy. I don't need to fulfill those commitments. They don't make me feel meaning anymore. We're not accountable. We don't have to do anything we don't want to do. If happiness becomes your moral compass, like pursuing happiness becomes your moral compass, you have no moral compass. Let me say that again because I don't think you heard me. If pursuing happiness becomes your moral compass, that's like what you're like setting your true north to, you have no compass at all because that is just blowing in the wind. What makes you happy today will not be the same thing that makes you happy tomorrow. And your circumstances will dictate your experience in life. That's a result of how that works. Because we have to control everything in our lives. We want to control how we live, how we think, and what we experience. And I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. Like this deep desire to control things was with us from the very start of how we are created as humans. I mean, let's look in Genesis. This is Genesis 3, verse 3. Where the snake is talking to Eve, and Eve says this. It says, only the fruit from the tree in the middle of the garden that we are not allowed to eat, God said. You must not eat it or even touch it, and if you do, you will die. But then the serpent responds and says, you won't die, the serpent replied to the woman. God knows that your eyes will be opened as soon as you eat it, and you will be like God. You will go from here, move him out of the way, and put him yourself here. You will be like God, knowing both good and evil. And the woman was convinced. Our first temptation wasn't pleasure. I think a lot of us can get this mixed up in our heads when we remember the story of Adam and Eve. It was about them doing what they wanted, sure. She made the decision for herself, sure. But it was like, oh, she'd know all these things. She have all the things she wants. It's for pleasure. No, no, no. The first temptation was for autonomy. To have control over who, like, controls me. I can control myself. I get to determine what I do and how I do it. Eve wasn't just choosing to be naughty like a kid who does something they're not supposed to do. It wasn't just that. What she was doing is there's a temptation for her to seek control. No one tells you what to do. No one tells you how to live. No one tells you how to think. It's your truth. It's your rules. You would be like God. That was the promise that was made to her. That's what she understood. But the truth of that temptation is that this is a desire for autonomy to rule over yourself, like that desire for that. It's just a cheap grab for control. Because you probably know someone in your life who feels like they have control over things, and you know how much of an illusion that is. You may think you have things in control because you have a rhythm, you have a routine, you have the walls you've set up. I structure things the way that I'm doing things. I have control. And it's an illusion. It's pushing away from the very design that God created us for, which is to embrace community and to live a shared life with others. If you have your Bibles, you want to pull this out because we're going to read this section along. We like to do this together as a church body. We're going to be looking in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And I wanted to use this passage because I think it speaks so directly as Paul's speaking to this church. He's talking about the issue of unity, of how there may be different parts that do different things of the body, but as we see, Jesus calls us as teaching these people, he's teaching us that the value of the shared life, that all the parts come together to make one whole. So again, this is chapter 12, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and starting in verse 12, says this. It says, the human body has many parts, but the many parts make up one whole body. So it is with the body of Christ. Some of us are Jews, some are Gentiles, some are slaves, some are free, but we have all been baptized into one body by one Spirit, and we all share the same Spirit. Yes, the body has many different parts, not just one part. If the foot says, I'm not a part of the body because I'm not a hand, that does not make it any less part of the body. And if the ear says, I am not part of the body because I'm not an eye, would that make it any less part of the body? If the whole body were an eye, how would you hear? So good. Or if the whole body were an ear, how would you smell anything? But our bodies have many parts, and God put each part where he wants it. God is the one who's in control. God is the one who's making the design for us. There's a purpose for the ear. There's a purpose for the eye, for the hand, for the foot. They're meant to not just work for the thing that they do best, but they're meant to work in conjunction with the whole. Do you see this? It's meant to be an entire whole. Verse 21 says, the eye can never say to the foot, I don't need you. Y'all hear me? The eye cannot say to the foot or to the hand, I don't need you. And the head can't say to the feet, I don't need you. In fact, some parts of the body that seem weakest and least important are actually the most necessary. All the parts matter because culture says you don't need anybody. Self-reliance. Trust yourself. Trust your instincts, your gut, what you can do. It's all about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and making it happen. That's what culture says. You don't need anybody, but the Bible says that we were designed to need each other. The eye cannot smell. The ear cannot touch. All the parts are meant to work as a whole. When culture pushes us to place our needs and our wants and our desires above God, above what God has called us to, and above others, we have to remind ourselves of our need, our great need for one another. And it's written deep within each one of us. Remember, our culture is teaching us self-reliance, but Jesus teaches the value of a shared life. We're all parts of one whole. Or to put it another way, where there might be that feeling of self-reliance is a weakness, you have to understand that our need for one another is not weakness. It's by design. It's not an accident that the eye cannot smell. Do you see this? We're meant to rely on one another in the context of community. I think especially for men from a young age, we're taught, well, especially in America, we're taught not just on the importance of self-reliance, but almost that it's looked down upon to ask for help. Or if you need help, you're weak. And so what happens? You don't ask. You don't seek it out. You don't build that muscle of looking for others to walk alongside you, to bear those burdens. But I'd go as far as to say this, that the life that God calls us to live cannot be lived alone. It can't. You're not meant to live completely in isolation, to pursue God in isolation. Yes, there are things that are your responsibility, personal devotion, personal discipleship that we take on. But doing this in the context of community is so important. I would say it's outside the design of God to do it otherwise. God calls us to live a life where we don't pursue happiness, we pursue meaning. Do you hear that? It's not about our happiness. It's about pursuing meaning. And when we pursue that meaning, especially in the context of community, that's when happiness can find us a lot of times. You ever felt that before? Where you feel like you're doing what God has called you to do. And in doing so, you experience that deep feeling of satisfaction, of gratification, and of gratitude even for what God has done and what he's doing in your life. We find meaning when we focus on others rather than simply just focusing on ourselves. And we see in the Bible of our deep need for that community, because it's not just a fluffy, like, we don't want to be lonely. I want to have someone to talk to. There's a need to rely on one another. The eye needs the hand. The ear needs the foot. In Ecclesiastes, we see an expansion of the same idea. In chapter 4, it says this, starting in verse 9. It says that two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, don't miss this, the other can reach out and help. You're meant to be together, but someone who falls alone is in real trouble. That's good stuff. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm. But how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and can be defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple-braided cord is not easily broken. Another way to say this in the Message translation, I think, really drives us home, is that by yourself, you're unprotected. You're away from the safety and security that community provides to you. And with a friend, you can face the worst. Can you round up a third? A three-stranded rope isn't easily snapped. Community is meant to be a protection for us. It's meant to be a safe harbor for us. And when we fall into the trap that culture leads us for, of do you, follow your truth, no one tells you how you get to be, we lose all the benefits and the gains and security that come from being in a thriving, warm, protective community. And Jesus didn't just teach about community. He modeled it, right? This is how he lived, and this is how he did his ministry. There are very few times in the Bible where we see Jesus being alone. And each time he is alone, it's very, very intentional, where he goes off to fast and pray. When he's in the Garden of Gethsemane before he's ultimately killed. Like, they're very intentional moments of isolation, of solitude. That's a part of it. But everything he does is almost exclusively done in the context of intentional community. And if anybody could do it alone, I feel like we could agree, probably Jesus, right? Probably Jesus. I mean, like, he's got all the stats, he's got all the attributes, he is fully man and fully God. But instead of going and just fixing everything and bringing everything to how he wants it to be, he chose to operate in the context of intentional community. 12 disciples, and then of those, three very close friends. He chose intentional community. He chose a shared life. Jesus was pursuing meaning in this life. He had a mission on earth, and it's the same mission that he invites us to even today. And we can't place our own desires, our own thoughts, our own pursuit of happiness above the richness that we find in biblical community. I say again, the life that God calls us to cannot be done alone. It's meant to be done in intentional community. Whenever I need to be reminded of what this kind of community can look like, I look into the book of Acts, the early church. And in chapter 2, verse 42, it talks about this. It says, all the believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to sharing in meals, including the Lord's Supper, and to prayer. It goes on and says, a deep sense of awe came over them all, and the apostles performed many miraculous signs and wonders. And all the believers met together in one place and shared everything they had. And it looks like this. They sold their property. They sold their possessions. They shared the money with those in need. They worshiped together at the temple each day, met in homes for the Lord's Supper, shared their meals with great joy and generosity. And it closes up by saying this. As a result of doing that, all the while praising God, enjoying the goodwill of all the people. And each day, the Lord added to their fellowship those who were being saved. This wasn't a moment, like Matt talked about last week. It's not a curated service on Sundays for 75 to 80 minutes. Those are good things. It's good to gather. It's better to share life with one another and to see what comes out of that experience. It's simply against our design because life, the life that God calls us to, cannot be done alone. It's done in the context of community. It's simply against our design to not do that. It's against how our Creator created us to exist. And culture slowly over time tries to get us to move from the place where we are the one who is in control. It's shifting us to the place where when you're in community, you don't have full control. As soon as you bring in one other person, now there's two people making decisions. Three. Now there's three people making decisions. Control gets more and more loose because you're choosing to share. You're choosing to trust. And control is absolutely laughable. To think that you have full control, like you might know a person in your life who like values having a lot of control over their life, and you know it's just a veil. It's a thin veneer over, that's like keeping them held together. And the smallest thing can cause that to come crashing down because control is simply just an illusion. Because remember, our culture preaches that self-reliance. You're in control, your thoughts, what you want is best. But Jesus continues to show us the value of a shared life. And the value of a shared life is the same of rich, fertile soil to a farmer. It's the same as like the warm home that protects you when it's cold outside. It's the same as the quiet confidence that like a loved child has when they're in the presence of their parents. That's the environment we're talking about. That's what is available to us to live as we walk this life. It's not a place we go to. It's a condition we can exist in. And while we understand this value, like you may have at some time been fortunate to feel those things I just talked about, where you've experienced that warmth, that safety, that security, that time where you had explosive growth in your life. You've seen and experienced that value, but at the same time, I have to pose a question. If we felt that, then why are we still choosing control over connection? Why do we choose control over connection? Because it's really the choice, isn't it? Having control, doing things your way, having your perspective, what I think matters most, what I feel is the right way to go, is how I will live my life. Instead of connecting with the Creator and those He has created, instead of finding meaning and sharing life with others, we're seeking the fleeting satisfaction that comes with having it my way. Why? I think to find an answer, it's going to be a personal one. You've got to be really honest with yourself because I think it's different for each person based on your experiences, based on how your personality is, like how you are, will kind of give a different understanding of the root of that desire. But understanding that root, why you hold on to control, why you want to and need to have that, is one of the best tools to combat that drift, that influence from culture. And if all this talk about community is kind of freaking you out a little bit, of like, I have to share my life with who? I got to do what now? I want to invite you to think about this a different way. We may have been kind of setting up this dichotomy of like the opposite of individualism is dependency. I'm either individual or I depend on someone. It's individualism and belonging. Individualism, what I think is best, what I know is best, I'm going to do it my way, treat yourself, do your things. The opposite of that is not being completely dependent on others. It's belonging with others. You see the difference? Because I think we all want to belong. Like when you find your place, your people at work, at school, at your gym, I don't know. Like when you find those people, it feels really good to belong. I think we've all experienced that at some point or another in life. I think that is the opposite of individualism. And I do have to admit, with individualism, one of the things that's really beautiful about it is celebrating the uniqueness of each person. I think that's a really beautiful thing because I think God has created each and every one of us to be a unique and individual creature that has things that are beautiful and that are special to that one person. I think it highlights who that person is. But when you share your life with others to belong, it doesn't mean you have to give that up. Do you hear that? Belonging isn't sameness. Belonging doesn't mean you ought to look the same. Doesn't mean you have to think the same. Doesn't mean you have to have the same values as this person. You might have different priorities in life at certain times. But what connects you is our connection to Christ. That we belong to Him, so we belong together. In fact, I'll say this a lot. A lot of times, With like a message like this, we're encouraging you to like find your community, like find groups, like here at Church Journey, that's kind of how you structure things. And that's a great starting point. I think you should. It's a great place to find a place to develop a shared life with other people. And a lot of times, you'll look for people who are just like you, like in the same life stage, they got the same stuff going on, the same struggles. That sameness can feel very safe. Anybody with me? Like, it makes sense? You find those people who are like you, and that's who you want to be around. But I want to encourage you to not get stuck on that. I want to tell you about Gordon. When I was just out of college, I was like 23, I can't remember, something like that. I took my first job out in California. I was at a church, and I just came on staff. I don't know nothing. Like, I'm dumb. I think I know stuff, but I don't know stuff. And we're at staff meeting probably like 3 or 4 weeks in. My boss brings in Gordon to come talk to our staff. And he's talking. And he's just kind of like, I'm just listening to him talk. I'm like, dude, this guy like knows some stuff. And I don't know what it was, but I was like, I want to know that guy. Like, I want to belong with that guy. So he gets done. And I kind of walk up to him afterwards. I'm like, hey, man, you want to grab lunch sometime? He's like, I don't need lunch. I'm like, okay. I was like, well, can we get like coffee or something? He's like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, I do that. I don't drink coffee. I do tea. So if you want to bring some tea, we can hang out. I'm like, all right. So next Tuesday morning, I bring his green tea. I bring my coffee. We sit down like 6:30 in the morning. Golly. And so we're just kind of chit-chatting, just kind of getting to know each other, asking him questions. He's asking me questions. We talk for probably like an hour and a half. And then I come the next week. Coffee, green tea. Right? Got both those. We're just kind of chit-chatting and learning about each other, sharing life with each other, sharing burden, like struggles he's got, struggles I've got, questions I'm asking him about his life, he's asking me about my life. When I met Gordon, Gordon was like 84. Dude lived a life. I mean, like, he was through his 50s. He did like nursing, and he like led like a nursing department at a local college and some other things like that. And then in the middle of it, he just kind of like shifted gears entirely to like counseling. He went through the process and kind of became a counselor. And like outside of both of us loving Jesus, there was not a lot the same with me and Gordon. But what I gained in belonging with him, just the time we spent together, and not even like I'm a mentee looking for a mentor. It was two guys who were just sharing life together. The richness that I experienced in that time is something I have a hard time putting a finger on even today, because it wasn't about me getting something out of him. It wasn't something him getting something out of me. It was simply walking a road with another person, and sameness didn't matter. And this week I've had something on my heart for like specific people in the room. And in the spirit of Gordon, I wanted to kind of put this challenge out there. I think there are some folks in the room who have a lot of life experience under their belt. And at this point, you feel like you've got, like, you have your friends, you have your relationships, and you have those people who are around you that, like, you've walked with before. But in this church especially, I feel like you might think you've got, like, I'm older, I'm going to be with these people, and this is what I'm going to do here. And there's like the other people in the church, they've got kids, they've got a life, they've got a career, they've got other stuff going on. They'll do their thing, we'll come together on Sundays, it's going to be a great thing. I want to say something, man. I want to encourage you to find those people and share life with them. Because there's people in these groups who are trying to work on a marriage and they've never seen a 45-year marriage before. They don't know what that looks like. They don't know how you work through that. There are dads who are trying to be a dad who have never had a dad. There are moms who are trying to be a mom who didn't really have a great mom growing up. And you can be those people for them in their lives. And it's not about you coming and forcing your way in. It's that shared life. You're sharing life with these people. They need to see what this like looks like. And I want to challenge you to find those people and share your life with them. Adopt their family. Get to know them. Let them get to know you. Like you're a fixture and a part of their life. Because it's not about you're in a different stage of life now. The ear needs the foot. The eye needs the hand. Y'all with me? We need that as a church. And it goes both ways. I think there's a lot of life that we can bring to one another as we share life together and to find and pursue meaning with one another. And I think this just echoes what Matt said last week, what we saw Jesus say earlier today, that following Jesus requires sacrifice. It requires submission. It requires a release of control. Jesus said in Matthew 16, he said, if any one of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way. You got to take up your cross and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. You must give up your own way. Stop putting yourself in the position of where God belongs and submit that to him. Choose to live a shared life, because culture preaches self-reliance, but Jesus teaches us the value of a shared life. And I'm going to leave you with a simple question. Who can you share your life with? Who are those people that you know that came to mind as I'm talking this morning? And make the ask, like have the conversation, have dinner. Like it doesn't have to be a formula. It doesn't have to be an 8-week study that you go through. It's about walking a road with people, sharing burdens, mutual sacrifice for the benefit of one another. It's not about putting your perspective ahead of other people. It's about thinking and hearing and following. What would it look like if we chose to live a shared life with others who were not exactly like us? We might encourage one another, challenge one another, hold one another accountable. This is the rich soil that we can grow in. That's part of the point of a church like this. So who can you share your life with? I want to challenge you this week. Find those people. Take those steps. Connect with those folks. Let's pray. God, we're grateful for your word. We're grateful for your challenge and the reminder of the gospel that it's not about how much we can try and push and pursue our own endeavors, but God, it's about laying our life down, taking up your cross daily. God, we're thankful for your grace that you made a way when we separated ourselves from God, and that you extended to all, regardless of circumstance or instance. Will we use that as a stepping off point to experience the growth and the security and the richness that comes from sharing life with one another? Would you put the right people on our path? Would you give us the courage to make the ask, to not say someone's no for them, to share life with other people? Here at Journey, sure, but also those in our neighborhood, on our kids' teams, at work. God, just give us the opportunity to share life with others so we might be a light. We would not be just influenced and pushed by culture to pursue our own means and our own desires above everyone else, but God, that you would give us a way to be more and more like you in the context of intentional community. God, we're grateful for your love. We're grateful for, God, just the model you set before us. Would you give us grace? So we pray. Amen.